In 1894, South Australia became the second place in the world to give women the right to vote and stand in Parliament. This feat wasn't achieved overnight, but through years and years of hard work and activism. In this podcast, we'll explore the lives and stories of some of the women who made this possible. Have you ever wondered about how paid sick leave, workplace safety, or the minimum wage came about? Well, these things weren't just handed to workers on a silver platter, they were fought for. Much like the right to vote. In this episode, we'll take a look at how the fight for fair pay and conditions for women helped bring about women's suffrage in South Australia, and one of the women who led the way on this issue, Augusta Sedale. The second half of the 19th century in South Australia presented a turning point for women's role in the workforce. While men were still strongly viewed as the breadwinners, with a rising female population and a growing economy, women had begun to play a larger role in the workforce during this time in South Australia. I caught up with Craig Middleton from the Centre of Democracy for a coffee to find out more.
There are a few different categories of work that women were undertaking, and the largest by far was domestic service, and that often wasn't paid. They also worked as paid servants as well as unpaid domestic servants. So we're thinking about the difference between their own work they did in their own homes, looking after their children and the work they did like that, and then they would also be paid servants. Factory work was another big thing that women were doing.
But while the number of women in the workforce had grown drastically, their paying conditions had not kept up. And in some sectors, women's pay was even being lowered as their participation grew.
So women were paid far less than men were paid. And even throughout the period where women were fighting for their rights at work, their pay increments were always based against a male wage. If they did something that was considered similar to male work, they might have got half the pay for that, even though it was the same job because of their status as women. So they didn't have a lot of rights, and particularly in the sort of 1880s and before the 1880s, working in factories, women would be working and children would be working up to 60, 70 hours a week in factories.
But all of this began to change in 1890 when the Working Women's Trade Union was established by prominent suffragists Mary Lee and Augusta Sedale. Upon its formation, the goal of this union was to win equal pay for women and bring an end to sweating conditions and long and unsafe hours, which many female workers were subjected to.
So after 1876, unions were legalised, and South Australia was actually the first place outside of the UK where that happened.
Over the next few years, Sedale, Lee and other unionists made important strides towards winning better pay and conditions for working women. Together, Sedale and Lee visited clothing factories and workshops to convince employers to adopt their log of wages and prices. Just 2 years later, in 1892, the Shop and Factory Commission was established to investigate the issue of sweating in factories. And in 1894, Augusta Sedale was appointed as the first female factory inspector, or factory inspectress, to use the lingo of the time.
She would basically go into the factories and inspect how the workers were being treated. She would inspect the conditions and how the machinery was working, you know, all of these things. And I mean, these positions were held by men before then, so there wasn't a new position, but she was the first female to hold the position. And, you know, these positions were appointed by the Premier at the time, so these were like significant appointments. And so you can imagine the pressure and the sort of the importance of such a role. So she needed to do it well, and she was passionate.
By giving women a voice in the workplace, by the end of 1894, Sedale and her fellow suffragists were able to give women a voice in Parliament and at the polling booth. Sedale's work didn't end, however, with the right to vote. She continued to campaign for safer working conditions for women until her untimely death in 1896.
She didn't take any leave whilst compiling her reports. From her perspective, I imagine it was for the greater good. It was the benefit of these women who weren't in such a privileged position as she was.
Since this time, a lot has changed for working women in South Australia. Sweatshop conditions are a thing of the past, equal pay and parental leave have been established, and over 60% of women are in paid work. But is the playing field really even between men and women in the workforce now? I spoke with Abby Kendall from the Working Women's Centre to find out.
No. Legally, you shouldn't be able to pay a woman less than a man, but that doesn't really attack the structures of our work, you know, who's doing the work and how we value the work and why we value the work because of, you know, who's performing it. One stat that I think is really important is the gender pay gap. We're paid less for the work that we do on the basis of our gender. There are industries in which women are the majority, make up the majority of workers, and that it tends to be low paid and low paid work, and it doesn't really reflect the skill set that is required for the job, but rather the low pay reflects the fact that women are doing work.
From my chat with Abby, I realise there are still a lot of long-standing structural and cultural issues in our workforce, but there are also new forms of discrimination and exploitation emerging, which are disproportionately impacting women.
Casualisation, insecure work, precarious work generally, it comes with this kind of glossy idea of flexibility, but what it really is, in my view, is it's a vehicle for corporations and companies to have people being paid, they're really employees, but pay them like independent contractors. Don't give them any entitlements, you know, annual leave, sick leave, superannuation, and make it seem like it's super flexible by saying you don't have a boss, but rather your work comes through an app. None of it provides any security to people. You're earning less than the minimum wage, which means that you've got to work more hours during the day. It becomes really unsafe. It's not healthy. Generally, it's just really bad for society.
According to a recent report by the Centre of Future Work, less than 40% of workers under the age of 30 are in full-time work. And for 28-year-old worker Shay, this is more than just a figure. It's a reality.
I'm currently a student. I'm studying a double degree, a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Media. I've had about 15 jobs in total. Majority have been casual, part-time. I've only had one full-time job. That was a traineeship in regional South Australia where I got paid like $300 per week working full-time.
While Shay had a full-time job when she was 18 as part of a traineeship, she struggled to find secure work since this.
The way that casualisation affects people is that it bleeds through into so many different aspects of their life. It affects your lifestyle and the way that you can organise yourself, whether it be the way that you can connect to your family or your friends. It affects the way that you can procure safe housing. If you have a casual job and you can't prove how many hours that you have, you're not going to get approved for houses.
The problems plaguing young workers don't necessarily stop once they've found a secure full-time job, with wage exploitation and underpayments rife across a number of industries.
The reason why I left my last job, which was a part-time role, it was severely underpaid. It was like an entry-level job where they were expecting ridiculous amounts of work in terms of like hours, overloading and skill. It's like even from like the very beginning, you are forced to accept jobs that you know are paid below the award rate because you know that it's so competitive out there.
While our current Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, claims that if you have a go, you get a go, young educated female workers like Shay haven't found this catchphrase to ring true for them.
When I was unemployed for about 9 months, I think I maybe got up to around 200 job applications without hearing anything back. And then I started finally getting interviews, but didn't really get anywhere. So I don't know what the baseline is for having a go is.
While Augusta Zadow and other suffragists fought to stop the mistreatment and exploitation of workers in factories, Shay admits that exploitation has become a bit of a norm in the workplace and doesn't always know what she can do about it.
It's very difficult to go against the grain without thinking that you're going to be punished in some kind of informal way, whether it be like having your shifts cut, social exclusion, even just those sort of more subtle, unpleasant ways of being treated, which doesn't necessarily fall into bullying or harassment, which is stuff that you can prove.
While workplace equality is far closer than it was 125 years ago, there's still a long way to go to ensure women have the same opportunities when it comes to pay, quality of life, and much more in Australia.
I think there's kind of two schools of thought. So there's one school of thought, which is, you know, oh, we need more women to be CEOs, and we need more women to get on boards, and we need more visibility for women in work. And that's a really popular school of thought. It's not that I don't agree with that. I think that would be great. But I think actually what's crucial to fixing the gender pay gap is changing our culture and society and the way in which we value women in society.
This podcast was proudly brought to you by SACOS, the South Australian Council of Social Service, and made possible with support from the Department of Human Services and Office for Women. A big thank you to the Working Women's Centre, the Centre of Democracy, and Shay Lee for making this episode possible.